Virginia Jaguar, after all, Second District Committee, Judith M. Cofield, pro se appellant, Mark R. Herring, Attorney General, Samuel T. Towell, Deputy Attorney General, Carolyn R. Zarowski, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Jerry H. Kelly, Assistant Attorney General, appellate.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. Obviously, I say it's a dubious honor to be standing here today. That said, I retire in about 3 months after 41 years, so I know in that four decades that your questions are more telling than my answers. I know you've read the briefs. So I ask you at this time, do you have any questions of me? And if not, I will reserve the rest of rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, Sherry Kelly for the Virginia State Bar. This case is about a lawyer's duty of honesty to the court when presenting and arguing the law. Ms. Cofield took a legal proposition from one source, a federal agency website, and she disguised it to appear as if it came from a different source, the Code of Federal Regulations. Four judges, including the three-judge circuit court below, concluded that this conduct is a knowingly false statement of law under Rule 3.3A1 of the Virginia Rules of Professional Conduct. On review, this court should give that panel's finding substantial weight and view it as prima facie correct. In three pleadings, Ms. Cofield included a sentence purporting to list five fees permitted under the HIPAA regulations. The first four items in the list were from the CFR, and they were in order and sequentially numbered. The fifth subparagraph was informational guidance that Ms. Cofield obtained from the HHS website. Immediately following this subparagraph was a citation, quote, see CFR 164.524, C3 and 4. And immediately preceding the list was a parenthetical noting emphasis in the original CFR. The implication was that the information was presented exactly as it came from the CFR. And Ms. Cofield included no citation to the website as the source of paragraph 5. So the statement of law at issue here is Ms. Cofield's representation that the CFR contains five subparagraphs when it in fact contains only four. Subparagraph 5 is sandwiched between the four items from the official CFR and a citation to that particular section and subsection of the CFR. And Judge Hall, in her testimony at the hearing below, stated that I absolutely thought we were talking about a CFR with those five paragraphs. This is a verifiably false statement of law. The CFR at issue includes only four subparagraphs. And subparagraph 5 was taken from informational guidance posted on the Health and Human Services website. Ms. Cofield's healthcare law expert at the hearing below testified that the CFR and the website are two different sources. They should be cited separately, and he would have cited the website as the source of subparagraph 5. Ms. Cofield argues in her opening brief that the website interprets the CFR, and with this we do not disagree, but Judge Quevedo's analysis below was correct. If you start with a statement of law, and then you go to another source that interprets that statement of law, you pull information from the interpretation, you cannot then cite directly to the original source. That is a misstatement of the law. This conduct is also distinguishable from a situation where two different parties in a case might have different opinions about the holdings of a particular statute or a particular case. That's an issue of interpretation of the law. And it's a matter of argument and advocacy in applying the law to the facts. Here we have a representation that a proposition of law came from a source that it did not come from. The record also shows that the statement was knowingly made. In response to a question from the panel about how subparagraph 5 found its way into Ms. Cofield's pleadings, she testified that she first went to the CFR to answer the question presented in the case, did research there, then moved on to the HHS website for additional information, found information there, and incorporated it into her briefs. So she had contemporaneous knowledge that the source, subparagraph 5, was the website and not the CFR. Ms. Cofield's response to Judge Hall's inquiry also shows her knowledge. She responded by providing a printout of the website. So she said to the court, this is my source for subparagraph 5. Says that she knew and she never made a claim that there was a mistake in her briefs or that she had accidentally transposed citations, and she had never provided any explanation for her decision to cite subparagraph 5 to the official CFR. Ms. Cofield claims that the submission of the website printout to Judge Hall in the underlying case adequately identified her source for subparagraph 5. But Rule 3.3A1 was violated at the time that Ms. Cofield filed the three pleadings with the court. Later conduct can be relevant to the question of whether or not a false statement of law is knowingly made, as it is here. But it does not negate the violation that occurred at the time the pleadings were filed and at the time the statement of law was made to the court.
Am I correct? The record reflects that what was submitted, apparently Judge Hall didn't get this, but what she got when she inquired with the clerk's office was simply the printout with no explanation. Is my recollection correct?
Your Honor, that's correct. I believe there was a cover letter just, stating that she was submitting the printout to the court. But it was just a printout of 6 pages of text.
Right, from the website. Just you pull up a website, hit print, and that's what you get.
Yes.
Right, okay. I just want to make sure I'm straight on facts.
The purpose of Rule 3.3A1 is to require honesty to the court at all times, not just when dishonesty is discovered. And as stated in Judge Hall's opinion, in the Lewis case, the printout did not provide the requested clarification about the regulation and why it was quoted with 5 subparagraphs rather than 4. Rule 3.3A's duty of honesty to the court is mandatory, not aspirational. We, as Virginia lawyers, are not only advocates for our clients, we're also officers of the court. And the rule reflects the reality that courts rely on attorneys to present the law to them in complex areas. A finding from Ms. Cofield would signal to Virginia lawyers that it is acceptable to cobble together propositions from multiple sources and then cite only to the most favorable source. And the bar submits that, as recognized by the panel below, candor to the tribunal requires more than this. The bar relies on its brief for the arguments not specifically presented today, and I'm happy to answer any questions. But if there are no questions, the bar requests that this court affirm the decision of the 3-judge circuit court.
Thank you very much.
There was one question before the court. What does CFR 45, CFR 164, 524 allow? One question. That question was answered. There are 5 costs allowed. This was taking place in a medical malpractice case, all I do. The only question before the judge involved the interpretation of federal law. The federal law was part of the Social Security Act.
Ms. Cook, wouldn't it have been so much easier just to say to Judge Hall, look, the 5th point is the administrative interpretation of this reg, and it's a correct interpretation, and that's what I was relying upon. I'm sorry I cobbled it all together to make it look like it was actually in the text of the CFR provision. But that was never said, and you sort of doubled down on it, it seemed to me, when they asked you about that and brought this proceeding. I'm not understanding that, Ms. Cofield. Why?
I would double down right this moment, because these are 2 lawyers talking to each other. This is not what is. I did not believe, didn't, and I think it's a sorry statement, did not then believe, do not now want to believe that the judge actually did not understand, although she admitted it under oath, what the privacy rule was. That is federal law. It is the simplification. I did not think I had to have the predicate of this is the federal law that you are charged with interpreting.
Right. Well, if I may interrupt there, but there's a distinction between the federal law as interpreted administratively, probably with some authority, and a reg. Because even a trial judge in Virginia can say, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to do what the administrative interpretation is. I just disagree with it. But if a state court judge can't say, I'm not going to do what the CFR says. So the fact that it was misrepresented as having a higher level of coercive effect on the trial court's authority, that's what Judge Hall was putting before you.
I disagree with you. She was not putting that before me. If you read her transcript, her testimony, she admits she had no idea what the privacy rule was. She thought the privacy rule was equivalent to this CFR. Indeed, the privacy rule covers 34 CFRs. It is a whole provision, Section 261 of the Social Security Act. She never understood, concedes five times, which is quoted in my brief, that she did not, until that moment she was in that courtroom, understand that the CFR at issue was distinct or discrete from the privacy rule.
Okay,
so, no, I also...
If paragraph 5 is absolutely right, let's say the U.S. Supreme Court rules this afternoon that's exactly the right interpretation of the reg. I'm not sure logically how that affects your case at all, because that's not the issue. The issue is not whether it's true or false or the best interpretation or the worst interpretation. But what was the source of that idea? Was it an administrative interpretation, which has weight but is not binding, or is it actually a properly promulgated rule of an federal administrative agency?
Well, if I take your question, and I happen to disagree with her, your characterization of her misunderstanding, because I had so many conversations with her, but if I take that predicate as absolutely correct and that characterization is accurate, then, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, but if I cite something more esoteric and I say, it's the sound and the fury of an idiot signifying nothing, and you say, where'd you get that from, Judy? And I give you Faulkner's book and I highlight the last chapter, the last paragraph, the last quote. Does that tell you where I got it from? If I lift it verbatim, and I lifted this verbatim, and the only question she had for me is, Judy, where did you get that fifth paragraph from?
Yeah, but if you told me the first time you said that, this is from Sir Thomas More, and that's the site, I go, wow, I didn't know you said anything like that. And then you later told me, no, it's not, it's from Faulkner. It doesn't change anything. It just means I was misled initially, and you corrected my misunderstanding.
Ignorance of the law is no excuse, is it?
I'm sorry,
is ignorance of the law an excuse? You know you should have four CFRs. Nobody's saying you don't. That's not the question before the court. The question is how many charges are permitted under this CFR? The answer is five charges.
Test out your logic. Suppose I knew that I'm the expert of CFR privacy rules. I'm not, of course. But I knew, and you sent this to me, and I knew, nope. Paragraph 5 is not part of the CFR. I've been doing this, been lecturing on it, blah, blah, blah. But you told me it was.
Right.
Why would it matter that I knew what you told me is wrong when the issue is, did you intentionally tell me something that was wrong?
Okay. As far as I understand Rule 3.3, excuse me, I have to knowingly misrepresent the law. Scienter must follow accuracy. It is an element just as the bullet and intent follows the bullet. If I know this to be a correct statement of law, I have not knowingly misstated the law. And I have three times the court there, admitting it is a correct statement of law. Three times he admitted that. You'll find that on...
There's sources of law. I mean, so suppose I tender something as being from the Supreme Court of Virginia to a circuit court, versus from the Supreme Court of Alabama. One's binding, one has persuasive force. They may be ultimately determined to be correct statements of the law. They're coming from different sources, and they have different preclusive effects.
They do not come from different sources in this case. They all come from the Secretary of Health and Human Services. All of them come because of congressional directive for her to, or him, to promulgate, interpret, and enforce the CFR, which she first designs and then interprets. So whatever she or he, the secretary, says is of equal force from the same source, and it is binding, not authoritative, not persuasive.
All right. And so So we're not even in Chevron deference. They just chuck something up on the website, and it's exactly the same thing as going through notice and comment in the CFR.
It absolutely is. And if you read Mr. Gravely's testimony, he was the only expert, and it was unrefuted. In there, he talks about the first place he goes as authoritative is to the website. Why? Because we have an ever-changing landscape of technology, and HIPAA's privacy and security rules, there are five rules under that, but of those two rules, which are most often invoked, they have to keep up with technology and Bill Gates. So as that happens, they promulgate, well, what we really meant in this is how you implement it. First place you go. Why? Because that's the ever-changing landscape response. The others are static. They are the answers to the questions.
Seems like we have a massive delegation problem then, but that's a wholly separate issue.
I don't understand your statement.
Don't
it's a delegation problem.
Congress delegating lawmaking authority to an administrative agency.
No, sir. And actually, when it delegated it, and when it was promulgated, it then enacted it. And it then said, what you say is law. And that is the simplification administration provision, which is the privacy rule, which is what I quoted from.
Counsel, I have a question. Whenever a website is cited, it is typically cited as last viewed on such and such a date.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that the case?
Because of what I just said.
Exactly.
No doubt.
Did you cite subparagraph 5 as being from a website last viewed on such and such a date?
The initial cite was not, well, it was never last viewed citation in the three memorandums. When asked on December 21st, where'd you get it from? 3 days later on December 24th, and in the appendix, I'm not sure of the page, I can give it to you in a minute. It's there, and it's quoted in red.
But when you
I give you the source. I hand you Faulkner's book.
You did not indicate this is from a website last viewed on such and such a date.
I did not say it was last viewed on this date.
Did you say anything to that effect?
Yes, when I gave her the book, I handed to her. It has a print date.
That wasn't my question.
I mean, it has a print date on it.
Okay.
That's what I'm trying to say. I'm sorry. When I hand it to her, yes, it does say that. Did I repeat that in the memorandum? No. Right at the top of it, it says last printed on.
But you've answered my question.
All I'm saying is if
you've
that...
answered my question.
Okay, thank you.
One thing I noticed is you in the, for example, on page 56 and 61 of the appendix.
What pages, sir?
Pages 56 and 61 of the appendix, which are some of the citations at issue. The second sentence here, for example, on page 56 of the... paragraph that begins with fees for copies says the fee may only, and then parenthesis, emphasis in the original CFR.
Mm-hmm.
And you go down and there's a emphasis, PHI is not already maintained or accessible, and that's part of part 5. Could a reader tie those together, because that's where the bold is, to conclude that that is in the text of the CFR, because the sentence says emphasis in the original CFR, and the emphasis is bolded there in Part 5, but of course Part 5 is the Secretary's interpretation rather than the CFR itself. Does that make sense, that someone could be mistaken because of that?
I would say somebody might be mistaken because of that, but if one read the CFR, one would see what is highlighted, and one would see what is highlighted is only, the word only, and it is underlined, and that is in the original CFR. So if one goes to the law, one sees the law.
Okay.
So further down, that emphasis was simply because we were arguing whether a fee was permitted when you have clinical information already electronically stored, as it was here.
Right.
So it didn't even apply in this case. So Her Honor's erroneous conclusion was not just legally wrong in the sense of you can award a fee, but it is another ruling saying you can't even do that fee, which we will give you if it's already digitally stored, and therefore it was immaterial and inapposite to the case at bar.
Ms. Cofield, honestly, though, our questions and your answers seem to be passing by each other. The charge in this case and what the three-judge panel has ruled is not that Provision 5 is an inaccurate statement of an administrative interpretation of law. That's not the charge. The charge is that it was represented incorrectly and knowingly as an actual textual provision of a CFR part. But it's not. What is it about that that you disagree with?
It totally escapes me.
Why?
Well, it totally escapes me because the law is rather clear, and I would expect a lawyer to understand the law.
Well, suppose someone told me Marbury versus Madison is an antitrust case. I swear to you, Judge, it's an antitrust case, and I go, how did that happen? I missed that. I know it's wrong. But if you're telling me it's an antitrust case, and you know it's not an antitrust case, and you're wanting me to believe it's an antitrust case, even though I know it's not, haven't you still violated the ethical canon to be straight up with the court? I mean, why does it matter that the person you're trying to mislead is actually misled?
I was not trying to mislead anybody, is your answer, number one. Number two, the question before the court was, what are the costs allowed under this CFR? The answer is five costs. I did not say subparagraph five. I said the answer is you've got five costs. If I put one star, two stars, three stars, four stars, and five stars, would it be different? Then if I use Roman numerals, would it be different? The answer to the question was how many costs. The answer was appropriately responded to in four briefs, two oral arguments, and as I stand here today, five costs are permitted under the CFR. You have to find on a standard of review, on an independent standard of review, that the court below, which found it was an appropriate statement of law, nevertheless violates 3:3.3. It is an anomaly to me that you can have a correct statement of law that is a knowing violation, a misrepresentation of law. It cannot be both. If it is correct, then you have not violated 3:3 or 3.3. That, to me, seems pristine. It has to be inaccurate. When it becomes accurate, and they concede it's accurate, that standard of review which you have
means they... So you did not intend, your whole point is you actually didn't intend Provision 5 to be understood as a textual provision within the CFR.
Of course not, because it's not. And if you read the CFR, you see there's four, and indeed it's numbered five paragraphs. It is not taken one small v for a Roman numeral, a fifth paragraph. I could see the point if I tried to bolderize the CFR, but if what I did was answer the question and I put five asterisks, would we not be standing here, or would we? Because that would be the same argument.
Judge Hall, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to leave you with that impression. It's poor drafting on my part, but I actually believe it's a correct statement. The interpretation is correct.
I assumed too much. I perhaps assumed too much. I do nothing but medical malpractice.
I've got one question for you, and I think this might be at the nub of this whole thing. You list the five different costs, and then at the end you say, see CFR 164.524, paren C, and paren 3, and paren 4, and paren. The language in 5 is not there.
Exactly. You only have, in those subparagraphs, the first four identifiers, if you will.
So don't you also need to see the website? I mean, isn't that the whole nother thing, that it would have worked out fine if you said CFR 164.525C3 and the website?
Of course it would have.
Why wouldn't you just say this other thing came from the website, it didn't come from here?
Because I did when I filed it with the court. I showed, this is the website. This I highlighted in red. This is the source. When she asked, what's the source? She never asked me, what is the privacy rule? It never occurred to me, in all honesty, that she really did not understand what the privacy rule was. I thought she did. The privacy rule is the umbrella to all of the CFRs. And that she thought I, and as she admits, in citing that fifth paragraph, was citing the privacy rule, does show a failure to communicate. But a failure to communicate or an improper citation is not a misrepresentation of the law. That it was not teased out initially in the memorandum is perhaps a fault, but that it is subsequently cured under the Blue Book standard, because the Blue Book standard for citation says if you have a digital reproduction that doesn't change the pagination, and you provide the digital reproduction as I did, that complies with the Blue Book.
Has she answered your question?
Yes. Thank
your
you.
Time has expired. Call the next case.